Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
This is the Shame-Free Zone, and I'm your host, Veronica Monet. It's Monday, the last Monday of August, the 30th. Wow, the summer has just zoomed by. I've got a very illustrious guest tonight. I think that's a good term to say. I went and Googled him. I mean, isn't that what we do nowadays? We just Google everybody. I Google myself. I Google my friends, try to figure out just how important are they really. So when I put this guy's name in, about 5 million hits come up. That's pretty amazing. That's a lot of internet pull. More impressive than that, though, because, you know, there could be a lot of John Robbins out there. My guest tonight, John Robbins, happens to be a very popular blogger on the Huffington Post. And several of his entries have actually just taken spot number one on Huffington Post. So if you haven't been over to read John Robbins' blog, you're missing out. But tonight, we've got him live. He's going to be with us for an hour, where we're going to be kind of letting this conversation wander around and take us wherever it wants to. But I have a feeling we're probably going to be talking about health, food, factory farming, animal cruelty. You know, they're all related somehow. Anyway, John, thank you for joining me in the Shame-Free Zone. I am truly honored to have you here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here with you.
I've already posted your links up on Facebook. We got a little bit of a conversation going on here about hormones in the milk and dangerous eggs. But I'm going to let you tell us a little bit about the blog on Huffington Post before we get deep into our topics.
Well, about 4 months ago, I started writing weekly articles for the Huffington Post. The Huffington Post is an amazing website. It is the seventh most popular news site on the World Wide Web. It is bigger than the New York Times. It is bigger than the Washington Post. It is bigger than the Associated Press. It is an amazing site, and it gets 28 million unique visitors a month, 28 million different individuals read the Huffington Post each month. And so it's a tremendous amount of exposure, and I've been writing these weekly articles, and in the last month and a half, some of my articles have exploded, and one became the most viewed piece, most viewed serious piece ever to appear on the Huffington Post. And several others are comparable in their popularity.
Was that the one about ice cream?
No, that was the one about the dark side of vitamin water was the title of it.
Yes.
And but the one about ice cream, and the one about ice cream, and I asked, are Monsanto's artificial hormones used in the production of your favorite ice cream? And the answer depends on what your favorite ice cream is.
Right. At Breyers, apparently, the answer would be yes.
Yes, Breyers is yes. Dreyers is yes. Haagen-Dazs is yes. Baskin-Robbins is yes. Ben and Jerry's is no. You know what's happened in factory farming is we treat the animals from whom we take our milk and our meat and our eggs as though they weren't living beings, as though they weren't creatures who draw breath from the same source as we do. As though they didn't have any needs, any emotions, any feelings, any sensibilities to pain or pleasure, we treat them like merchandise. We lock them up in cages so small they can barely move, in some cases so small they cannot move for their entire lives. We feed them diets stunningly unnatural. We subject them to conditions that the criteria for those conditions is only one thing, and that's the profit margin. There is no concern whatsoever for the well-being of the animals. And the question I ask for our listeners is this. Why is it that we treat some animals what we call ants. We call some animals pets, and be they dogs or cats or other animals that we call pets. And then we treat them as part of our families. We lavish our affection on them, and we get tremendous amounts of connection in return. They are really part of our families. And they, in those relationships with those animals, enrich us as human beings. They deepen our connection to life itself. They give us some connection to our natures and to the powers that work within us that enlivens us and makes us better people. But then, why is it that we call other animals livestock? And by virtue of that semantic distinction, feel entitled to treat those animals with any manner of cruelty so long as it lowers the price per pound? Where does that disconnect come from? And what does that disconnect cost us? And you see it in dairy farms, you see it in egg ranches, you see it in cattle feedlots, you see it in pork production, you see it across the board in agribusiness factory farming, where these creatures are treated, every one of their natural urges is frustrated. All of their needs are violated. And it's a sacrilege, and it's a tragedy to the human-animal bond. We do something to ourselves when we do this. We do something to the web of life when we do this. And yet, it's become par for the course in the industry today.
And I think, you and I, of course, have had this discussion before, and I think one of the things that overwhelms a lot of people is that they may feel that they have certain dietary needs, and it's difficult for them to envision anything that could be humane. So I think they give up. They're like, well, I've either got two choices. I become a vegan, or I participate in things the way they are.
Veronica, fortunately, there are now more and more opportunities to purchase humanely raised animal products, grass-fed beef, free-range eggs, organic products. They aren't, sometimes those terms are hype. The word natural doesn't usually mean anything, unfortunately. It's a marketing slogan. But there is increasingly an awareness that there is a market. Just as there is a market for organically raised broccoli, and generally it fetches a higher price because it's a purer product than conventionally grown broccoli, for example. We're starting to see animal products that are raised in a different way, where the conditions don't resemble concentration camps, where the animals are in pastures, in barnyards and farms, where they actually see a blade of grass and eat it, where they actually are outside in an environment that begins to resemble the kind of environment in which they thrive.
Well, there is actually an organization called the Humane Farming Association, and I'm a supporter of that, and I think you have personal ties to the founders.
I do. I know Brad Miller very well. The Humane Farming Association is a wonderful organization. There are others working for that same purpose, the Humane Society of the United States, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. HSUS, the Humane Society of the United States, is probably the largest. Focusing on factory farms and trying to get the laws changed. For example, we have recently had a really large recall. Over a half of a billion eggs have been recalled, over 500 million eggs, due to salmonella poisoning in these eggs. And they're not just on the shell, they're inside the egg. So anyone eating sunny side up eggs or scrambled eggs that were a little runny, much less a raw egg, could get very, very ill. And if that person was old or young or had a compromised immune system for any reason,
sure,
it could be fatal.
I think the only way the eggs were safe is if you hard boiled them, right?
Yeah. And even then, the truth is you're touching the eggshell when you handle it. And the shell can carry it, too. So there really isn't any 100% safety for someone whose immune system is weak.
I just got to replace things from Sprouts that I unfortunately decided I'd just rinse off and eat them anyway.
Uh-huh.
And that happened about a month ago, and man, I was just down for about 2 days. I couldn't function at all.
What food was that?
Sprouts, mung bean sprouts. I had unfortunately
mung bean sprouts.
I left them in the fridge too long, and they smelled a little ripe when I opened the carton, and I just decided to rinse them off and eat them anyway. So I won't be doing that again.
Yeah, you know, food safety is something we all have to be responsible to. But I don't like the egg industry trying to sell consumers, oh, you just hard boil the eggs and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
That's putting too much responsibility. If an industry is providing a product, they have the responsibility to be sure that that product is safe. Now, accidents happen. Food is never 100% safe, and we can make some allowances. But when 500 million eggs come down the pike from two farms or factory farms in Iowa, and they're all carrying salmonella, that's out of hand. Now, the Humane Society, HSUS, the Humane Society of the United States, has tracked this, and they have found, and I've written about this on the Huffington Post, that the what are called battery caged hens. This is standard operating procedure in the industry. 95% of America's eggs come from caged hens today. 95%, the vast, vast majority. And these cages are so cramped. These birds are crammed in there so tightly, they can't even begin to lift a single wing for their entire lives. They are rubbing against other birds and the wire cages constantly. Their feathers get rubbed off. I've been in these places. They look more like walking wounds than they look like birds. They're grotesque, and they're sick, and birds die in these cages all the time, and their dead bodies just lay there, and the other hens just squish, walk on top of them. They have no space, and this is the conditions from which 95% of America's eggs come. And the Humane Society of the United States has, by the way, this is illegal in Europe. Caging hens like that is illegal in Europe, and both the state of California and the state of Michigan have passed laws phasing it out in the next few years. So that's a good thing.
What is it, 2012 or 2014 that the state of California will be?
That's a two-stage process. In 2012, the state of California, you won't be allowed to house hens like that any longer. By 2015, no egg can be sold in the state that it comes from hens that have been caged like that. So that means the state can't import into the state from other states or Mexico eggs produced under those conditions.
Wow.
So we've got to get these birds out of the cages. You know,
it's just like when I go in and talk to the college students about sex worker rights, and I talk about people who are you know, sex workers who are being murdered and raped, and how we need to change the laws to protect them. It's very difficult for me to get people to actually really care what happens to sex workers. So I found that it's a much more successful strategy for me to go in and talk about a lack of sexual bill of rights and how it impacts people that I'm talking to, because, you know, unfortunately, people have more self-interest than they do humanitarian interest a lot of times. I think people have good hearts in general, but they feel overwhelmed, and so it's about all they can do to keep up with their own interests. And I think that the real important point here is that a lot of the salmonella that we're talking about, or the E. coli in the spinach, all of it has been a byproduct of factory farming. So, you know, the food supply really is at risk right now because of the way we're treating animals. So
it's true. I mean, the studies have all shown, all the studies show, that salmonella is vastly more prevalent in eggs from caged hens than from hens who are cage-free.
Exactly.
And even far less prevalent if they're free-range. Similarly, the E. coli that was found in the spinach was a product of animal poop, animal manure.
It was runoff from a factory dairy farm that was local to that spinach farm, right?
That's correct. And so, you know, it all, the I mean, we can get bad sprouts. We can get sometimes problems with vegetables and fruits. They're not necessarily and always safe, but 95% of the time, it's animal products that are the origin, and 99% of those times, the problems in those animal products stem from factory farming. See, the distinction here is factory farming versus something like family farming. We have agribusiness today dominating the industry, and treating the animals putting the animals in conditions that are so sad. I really want to emphasize this. You don't have to be an animal rights activist. You don't have to be a vegetarian to be appalled by how severe it is if you see it. But the industry does everything it can to keep the veil between our eyes and the reality. And I'm doing everything I can to lift that veil so people can see what is the case and then make informed choices. I'm not telling anybody where they should draw the line. I'm not telling anybody what their level of compassion should be. But I do think that if you're going to make choices that are consistent with your heart, that are consistent with your values, that are consistent with your health and your highest good, then you need to have accurate information. And you will not get that from the government. You will not get that from the industry. They are in collusion together. So it depends then on individual and groups who are working to raise awareness and talk truth to the American people so that we can develop the collective will to make the changes that are needed.
So I put your question out on Facebook, actually, and I said, why is it that we treat some animals as part of our families and yet treat other animals with cruelty? And there's a response. I'm going to read it in a minute. I want to preface this by saying, first of all, thank you very much for participating here on Facebook. And second of all, it's a really interesting response, one that I think is pretty common. And I think you'll see when I say it here. C.L. Osborne says, why is it that we treat some animals as part of our families and yet treat other people with cruelty? And people is in big capital letters. What I have often found is that, putting out any interest or concern for animals can sometimes elicit that kind of comment. It's certainly something I've gotten from my mother a lot, which is basically like, we need to be worried about the people. You know, we don't have time to worry about the animals. We got to worry about the people. And I just want to put that out there and ask you, first of all, have you seen a lot of responses like that? And then second of all, how do you respond to it?
Yes, I've seen that often, as you have. I've been involved with animal protection, animal rights, animal welfare movements for many, many years. And I've met all kinds of people who are likewise involved. I would say that, in general, by far, they are more concerned about human welfare, about human rights, about issues of poverty and oppression of women and racism and all the many, many ways, and militarism and all the ways that humans are harmed, than people who aren't involved in animal rights. It's not an either or. It's not that you have compassion for animals and you only have so much compassion, and so if you send it in the animal direction, you have less to give to the human direction. It's the size of your heart. It's the, how big is your compassion? It's how willing are you to care? And it hurts sometimes to care. A lot of us are in compassion fatigue. We're exhausted by the level of pain, the level of frustration, the level of grief and loss that surrounds us and that is inside us.
Well,
and we don't know how to cope with.
We have a lot of exposure nowadays. I mean, the world has gotten very small, and we're, you know, it's like I'm watching Spike Lee's Katrina, documentary, and it's 4 hours long, and I'm crying, and I can only take about 30 minutes of it, and then I have to walk away.
So I understand.
We all do.
The only thing is that we eat 3 meals a day, most of us, and all of us eat, and we have options there to eat in ways where there's misery on our menu and cruelty in the diet or not. And I think that we can make choices there that end up healthiest for us, that lower the level of saturated fat in our bloodstream, reduce our exposure to pesticide residues and toxic chemical residues that work their way up into higher concentrations as you work up the food chain. We can often make the same food choices that are healthiest for us personally are also the ones that are kindest to the other animals and also the ones that use up the fewest resources, therefore are most environmentally benign and allow the food resource base to be available to feed other human beings. There's a deep issue here about human hunger. At present, there are about 1 billion people on this earth who are malnourished from lack of food. Some of them are dying of hunger. Others are simply malnourished from hunger, but they're susceptible to diseases because of it. And there are, at the same moment on Earth, the same number, about 1 billion people who are overweight, who are suffering from diseases caused by eating too many calories, too much fat. It's amazing, this lopsided, weird mirror image. And when we eat a lot of animal products, more than is good for us, what happens is we are consuming more land, more water, more human labor, in effect, in so doing, than is our share. It takes 16 pounds of grain to make the average pound of U.S. feedlot beef. It takes only 1 pound of grain to make the average pound of rice or bread. So when we eat, and beef is the most egregious in this example, in this manner. When we eat animal products, and particularly beef, what we're doing is we are taking too big a bite out of the planet's capability to feed people and leaving less then for the world's less fortunate at an economic level. They can't afford to compete with us, and so they don't eat. So when people say to me, oh, you're concerned for animals, you should be concerned about people. I am concerned about people. I'm very concerned. One of my books is titled, May All Be Fed. I gave a speech at the UN on world hunger and got a standing ovation for it. I've been speaking about these issues for a long time in many places. And if we're going to develop an agriculture that truly is dedicated to providing healthy people for as many people as we can, we have to get away from feedlot beef. We have to get away from these concentration camp conditions because although the food they provide is cheap, it is still consuming extraordinary amounts of resources and producing phenomenal levels of pollution.
Now, I don't want to go down this alley too far here, but there is some argument that, you know, like I eat a diet that's just like organic fruits and vegetables and fish. And I've heard that if everybody ate a raw food diet, everybody was eating fresh fruits and vegetables, there wouldn't be enough fresh fruits and vegetables to feed everybody. That people need to eat, you know, things like, I don't know, I guess grains in order for the whole planet to be fed. What do you think?
I think that's true. I think grains are remarkably productive per acre compared to fruits and vegetables, and particularly at a calorie level. And most people do well with whole grains. Some people don't. I know you don't, Veronica, and you have an allergy, and that's limiting to you, and you should get food that's healthy for you. But when you're speaking of the overall populations, most cultures have based their diets traditionally on whole grains, be it quinoa in South America, millet in certain parts of the world, Eurasia, corn in this country. The Native Americans based their diet on corn; it was holy to them. And rice in Asia, whole grains have been the staple for many, many cultural traditions. And so they are remarkably prolific.
We've got a comment here on Facebook from Nicholas Binion. I got a couple of comments from him, actually. And he says, people should be aware of the Harvard study on global hunger and the UNICEF reports from years ago that conclude that the rich man's cow eats the poor people's grain. Reducing
exactly.
our dependence on animal husbandry ultimately frees resources for people, especially going for range-fed animals as opposed to factory farming. So that's pretty much in line with what you're saying?
Yes, it is. And again, referring back to the person who asked the question about caring for people, my experience is that when we care for people, we are more likely to care for animals also. And when we care for animals, we are more likely to care for people also. Now, there are some exceptions to that. But in general, as a person's heart becomes connected to life, they find their caring activating their actions. They find their actions then congruent with their caring, and that's a big step.
And it's reflected by another comment here. This one's coming from Alan Perry Jr., and he says, that depends on the person. Most of the people you are talking about are different because those that treat animals as family aren't most likely going to be mean to other animals. The only thing that I would say about that, though, is that if we do make cruel choices, as you were saying, with what we choose to put in our mouths because of a lack of awareness or the fact that we just feel like it's too overwhelming to get involved and make, you know, better choices, then we may not ever physically harm another animal personally, and yet we are responsible for the suffering.
Well, the industry does a lot. You see, that's the veil, to protect us from experiencing the consequences of our actions.
Yeah.
They protect us from seeing the misery that the animals whose flesh we eat, or whose eggs we eat, or whose milk we drink, have undergone. That's an uncomfortable subject. It's an unpleasant subject. It's disturbing. And most people don't want to think about it. And as a result, they're only too happy to collude with the industry in not thinking about it. And so they even use, we even have words for, you know, we say it's a steak. We don't say that it's the muscle of a cow.
Right.
But it is. And we don't tend to think of that this really was an animal's wing, a bird's wing, or this came from the udder of a cow, and it was designed to feed her calf. We don't like to think about that. We don't like to think about the animal's involvement, but it's there. And I think it is a basic human obligation, if we're going to use animals for our food, we should treat those animals with respect. If we're going to kill them for our meat, we should do so in a way that is as humane as possible. Some people say humane slaughter is a contradiction in terms. It may be. But we can still do it as humanely as possible. And yet, in the industry today, it is done as cheaply as possible. Profit governs all of the decisions, and the well-being of the animals aren't even part of the equation. See, right now we have laws against cruelty to animals,
they don't apply because they're not considered animals.
If an animal is destined for human consumption, it is exempt from the legislation, and the farm bureaus in every state have worked assiduously and successfully to keep those qualifications in place. What that means then is that, the food, the animal products that are available to us are, for the most part, the products of extraordinary amounts of suffering. Now, to me, that elevates the search for either a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet or a way that those kinds of diets can be healthy and satisfying and rich, or diets that use animal products, but those animal products are from different kinds of conditions. It elevates that to a moral imperative. It isn't just a luxury. It's not just for people who are wealthy and shop at Whole Foods and have elitist ideas. It actually becomes part of our connection to the circle of life. part of our involvement in the greater web, the greater Earth community? And are we going to live with respect for ourselves and each other and the whole Earth community, or are we not?
I think if you have a spiritual life and you envision how we're all connected, you can't suddenly draw the line at the refrigerator.
That's beautifully said. I like that.
And if your food isn't spiritually in sync with your values, then I think, you know, I think eating something that has suffered is, on some level, eating suffering.
You know, I've had discussions with this about this with people in animal agriculture at various state universities throughout the country. And, you know, they tend to, if you can't quantify it, if you can't measure it, then it doesn't exist to them. And yet, over a beer, when we're talking about it, it's very interesting what they say. Because these animals, for example, in the factory farms, these animals live in fear and deprivation their whole lives. Then they're slaughtered in slaughterhouses where no effort is made to protect them from seeing and smelling and hearing what's coming. So they have very strong instincts to fight or flee for their lives when they sense their lives are in danger. And they sense that in the slaughterhouses. Again, no effort is made to shield them from what's in store. So they secrete epinephrine and ephedrine and adrenaline and these various hormones of stress, of flight and fear, and actually, it's actually the biochemistry of terror. And they secrete these substances, and they course through their bloodstream into the muscles to enable those muscles to fight or flee powerfully to save their lives. But they're restrained. They're not allowed to fight. They're not allowed to run. They're not allowed to move. They're completely constrained, and then they're killed. And these uncombusted substances, the biochemistry of terror, remain in the muscles that we then call stakes. Now, if an animal has lived and died in fear and we eat that animal's flesh, what effect does that have on our emotional well-being? If we're people who hearken to the prayer, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me, if we want to take responsibility for the quality of our lives and the experience we have of ourselves, what are we doing to ourselves when we're eating the flesh and the products of animals whose lives have been nightmares? I want to stop
here. Do you have any scientific information about that, or...
Well, as I say, there isn't. It's difficult to measure it, but the same people who will say on the podium when they're representing industry, or on NPR when they're paid by the Cattlemen's Association or the Pork Producers Association or the Dairy Board to make these statements, afterwards over a beer or at dinner, whatever, in a cab ride on the way back to the hotel with me, when we talk about it, invariably they say, you know, I can't prove it, but I think you're right.
That's amazing.
Because, yeah, and there's a very interesting woman named Temple Grandin. She's an autistic woman.
Oh, thank you. I was just going to bring her up, and I actually wanted you to address the fact that Temple Grandin's gone out of her way to try to make the slaughterhouses more humane and how you feel about that.
I nominated Temple for a PETA award a few years ago, which she was given, which is very controversial because PETA is generally in favor of the abolition of factory farms, and here is in slaughterhouses, and here is a woman who's trying to make slaughterhouses and factory farms more humane. It worked. PETA did give her the award, and I was very proud of that because I'm proud of her, and I'm glad for many of the things she's doing. She is herself autistic, which is not an easy thing for a person to deal with, but it has given her an empathy with animals that most of us don't have. And from that point of view of that empathy, she's designed slaughterhouse arrangements, chutes, and so forth, that are more comforting to the animals and less damaging to them, less emotionally stressful. It is a step in the right direction. It's a rather significant step in the right direction, I would say. However, the whole weight of the industry, the whole commercial reality of the industry and economic reality of the industry is pushing in a different direction. So I admire Temple, and I respect her, and I support her work, and I recognize what she's up against. These people want to lower the price per pound, and that's pretty much all they got in mind.
True. And, of course, too, I just want the listeners to keep in mind that there's two different things going on here. There's, Temple Grandin has worked on humane slaughtering, but that has nothing to do with preventing the animals from being in feedlots that require massive doses of antibiotics or subjecting them to growth hormones.
Temple has viewed a number of organizations that I'm involved with have gotten undercover footage of factory farms and brought that to the attention of the press. And often when that happens, the Pork Producers Council or the National Cattlemen's Beef Association will send their PR person to say, it's not really as bad as it looks. These are just from an amateur point of view, it looks bad, but really it's not that bad. And then we will often ask Temple to give her thoughts on it, and she'll say it's repulsive. It's atrocious.
Yeah.
This is not how animals should be treated. This violates everything that's basic about human decency and animal welfare. And she's part of the industry, but she isn't paid off in the same sense. She's got integrity and won't lie because she's paid.
I'm a big fan of Temple's. I've read her books. I saw the movie Claire Danes starred in playing her on an HBO special recently. But still, the issue being that even if we improve how animals are killed, that when factory farming forces them into small crowded spaces and that remains that they have to be on antibiotics, another health risk around that being that we continue to create super viruses because we're pumping antibiotics into all these animals that we eat and into the environment.
You're absolutely right. It's super bacteria because
bacteria
that are susceptible to antibiotics. And therefore, if you wanted to breed, if you wanted to create a system to successfully breed bacteria that are resistant to our antibiotics, to the basic weapons we have against bacterial infections in our medical system for people, you could not design a system more effectively than what we have in factory farms. Because this is also particularly true in beef cattle, by the way. Beef cattle are fed regularly in feedlots antibiotics with every dose of food they eat, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's mixed in. It comes with the food. And the reason that they do it, if this isn't to treat animals who are ill, this is as growth promotants because they don't fully understand the mechanism, but they have found that animals in these conditions do not thrive. Big surprise. But
right.
If they are given regular doses of antibiotics, they do thrive. Thrive in the sense that they gain weight long enough to be slaughtered. That's the definition of thrive. It's an economic term, really. But what that means is these animals' guts, and a cow, remember, has four stomachs, so there's a lot of gut there. It's filled with bacteria, and what you're doing is you're continually killing any bacteria that would be sensitive, that would be susceptible to the antibiotic. But if a bacteria should mutate and arise that is not susceptible to the antibiotic, it has got a perfect environment to proliferate in because it doesn't have any competition from bacteria that are killed by the antibiotic. They're all killed off by the antibiotic. So the milieu is just ripe for the proliferation of resistance. And that is what happens. And then residues end up in the meats and the dairy products that people eat. They end up in the air. They end up in the water. They end up on the farmer, the workers' clothes and hands and in their breath and their lungs. And it spreads through the entire earth.
Yeah.
And then
well,
it gets into people.
Maybe you can clarify something for one of the listeners here. Mel Hopkins says he doesn't drink milk. Matter of fact, he said, I should add, I stopped drinking milk soon after elementary school. I stopped eating ice cream, cheese, and other dairy products in February of 2010. I stopped drinking milk and eating dairy products because of the mucus that it produces in me or humans in general. I'm not sure the mucus is a result of hormones or antibiotic vaccinations. I have no proof that dairy farmers give their dairy cows vaccines, but I have read that may be the case. Now, I think you're saying they absolutely give dairy cows vaccines, or
Yes, they do. They give them vaccines. They're required by law to give them vaccines. They're not required by law to give them growth hormones, but about 45% of them do,
okay.
Close to half.
Yeah.
And the hormone it's called bovine growth hormone. It's a genetically engineered hormone. It was the very first genetically engineered product to ever enter the human food chain. Monsanto developed it. Monsanto fought like crazy to get it through the FDA. A very controversial decision. The FDA did approve it. It is not approved in Canada. Banned in Canada. Banned in every one of the 27 countries of the European Union. It's banned in Japan. It's banned in New Zealand. It's banned in Australia. It is banned almost throughout the entire world, industrialized world. But in the United States, we use it a lot, and it is not banned, and Monsanto has got a lot to do with that. It is it's a hormone that's injected into the cows, and it does cause them to give a great deal more milk. That's why it's done. However, it causes them to develop udder infections called mastitis. They all do. It's inevitable. You inject a cow with bovine growth hormone, that cow will get mastitis. The udders get huge. They get distended to the size. They're almost drag on the ground. Their calf couldn't nurse physically if it were allowed to try, which it isn't. And then so the mastitis is there. There's pus in the milk, increased white blood cell count in the milk. And the animal's given antibiotics to treat the mastitis. So then you get residues from that antibiotics in the milk, and you get the breeding of resistant bacteria in that animal's guts and eventually in our world. A strict vegan is not immune because from antibiotic-resistant bacteria, it's not just by eating these products that we introduce them into our systems by any means. Once they exist in the world, we can be exposed to them any number of ways.
Absolutely.
And, yeah.
Yeah. No, and that is the whole point here, this chain of life that we are ignoring. Becky Barnes says, I think the hormones in our food have caused a lot of endocrine issues. I think it's wrong to have hormones, antibiotics, pesticides, et cetera, near our food. There are better ways to raise those animals in the food we eat so we wouldn't have to use so many chemicals. What about that? Have we seen any endocrine issues? As a matter of fact,
it's pronounced endocrine. Yeah, that's the endocrine system is the hormone systems of the body. And she's absolutely right that in introducing all of these chemicals and mm-hmm. into our production systems, we have wreaked havoc on our own endocrine systems. A case in point is the onstage of what's called menarche, for the first menstruation that a young girl will have. Historically, girls would start to menstruate at the age of 16 or 17. As we have changed the Western diet and introduced all these hormones into it, that age has dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. Today in the United States, it's around 11 on average. The average girl has her first period at the age of 11. Now, that means that the amount of estrogen circulating in her system are greatly increased. This raises her risk lifetime greatly of ovarian cancer, breast cancer, and uterine cancer. It also means that she's going to enter puberty and sexual activity at a much earlier age than she would have naturally. And is she prepared for that? Is her mental and emotional state ready for that? you know, it's an abrupt and it's a forced entrance rather than a gradual evolution into sexuality and into her womanhood. I think we're messing around with stuff here that's very harmful. And the disruption of our endocrine systems, and there are other chemicals in the environment as well that do this. There's a whole host of endocrine disrupting chemicals in our environments today.
Well, and you've actually wrote an article about babies, female babies growing breasts in China, and you want to elaborate on that?
We've had outbreaks very recently in China and a few years ago in Puerto Rico where little girls, 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old girls, were starting to menstruate, were developing breasts, growing pubic hair. It's egregious.
2 to 4?
Yes. Yeah, there is one case where an 18-month-old girl was actually growing pubic hair and starting to bleed.
Oh, my God.
It's terrible. It's terrible.
I mean, why is that happening in China and not happening here? What?
Well, we're still looking at what the cause was in China. All of the infants involved in this latest situation were consuming the same dairy formula. But the Chinese government has not been forthcoming about what the cause is. It appears to me that they're protecting, it's a very large corporation there, Chinese corporation that makes the formula. And the Chinese export a tremendous amount of food products to this country. They don't want a shadow cast on the safety of those foods because it might impair their ability to sell those products here. But that shadow already exists. When we buy food from China, even if it says it's organic, well, the surveillance in China is a lot less. We don't have very good surveillance here. We don't have very good food safety regulations here.
Not
but
when
there,
Monsanto and the FDA are in bed with each other.
They are. You know,
okay, so I get the upshot. China is not going to tell us what happened, but why do you think that's not happening here in the U.S.? What's the distinction?
Well, what we're seeing is not so much outbreaks of this horribly precocious puberty, but what we're seeing is a new normal, which is really precocious puberty, not that extreme. But to me, you know, there are 8-year-olds menstruating now. Particularly African American girls, for some reason, they're starting to menstruate earlier even than white girls, there's 11-year-olds and 10-year-olds and 9-year-olds and 8-year-olds now, and it's just getting earlier and earlier, and some of this has to do with the fat levels and the body fat levels that young girls are carrying.
Right.
Some of it has to do with the estrogens circulating in their system because of chemicals that are estrogen mimicking. Some of it has to do with the hormones that are used, injected into dairy cows, whose milk, whose cheese, whose yogurt, whose ice cream they're eating. But it's like the frog in water, and the water is gradually heated up until it boils.
Yes.
And we're getting used to it. We think of it as normal. It's aberrant, and it's toxic, and it's painful. And we need to recognize it so that we can do something about it. And it is painful. I sometimes wish I wasn't bringing a message that was as provocative and had as much anguish in it as what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But the reality, we need to face the reality. And if we're going to treat ourselves better, if we're going to learn to treat others better, if we're going to learn to live with some love in our lives, and so that love is the central driving connection between us and other people, I would like to see that day happen. I would like to see the day come that our lives are brought forward by the love in our hearts, an expression of the love in our hearts, and a celebration of the love in our hearts, and the joy and the beauty that we can create together. But we need a healthy world And we need a healthy way of life to do that. We need a spiritually fulfilling way of life. We need an economically and socially just way of life. We need an environmentally sustainable way of life. We can do that.
I'm gonna pose something to you here, because I've got some comments here. And again, I want to thank the listeners for participating here, regardless of what your comments are. They're all valuable. But we've got a comment from Hokie Wolf. He says, I accept it as something we just have to live with. The question that I said was, you know, does it bother you that there's hormones in your milk? And then we've got Rodney Phillips, who says, I haven't grown breasts yet, so I'll stick with it for now. Laugh out loud. That's not an uncommon response. And what do you think it's about? Do you think people are just shut down? Do you think they're overwhelmed? Do you think that they've completely bought into marketing, or is it that they trust the government too much? What would you chalk it up to?
Well, all of the above, and our need to be in denial about things that are might be hurting us. We can accept as normal things if our society says they're normal. But to step outside of that cultural trance and to look with fresh eyes at what we're doing and ask deep questions about, is this right? Is this good for us? Is this creating the kind of world and the kind of health that we and our children and our grandchildren and everyone's great-grandchildren need and deserve? Are we living the kind of lives that are worthy of all the suffering that is entailed in the human experience, that make it meaningful, make it worthwhile, make our lives worthwhile? Are we authentic to ourselves? Are we sincere about what we're doing? Or are we on automatic? Are we sleepwalking through it all? These kinds of questions are not easy. They're difficult. They're complex. They challenge the conditioning and the ways that we have coped and shaped ourselves to adjust to a sick society. But they are also liberating, because they can give us back to ourselves and back to what really gives us life and lead us back to our spirits and our strengths. And to our wholeness.
And I have purposely picked some of the more negative comments so that we'd have a discussion here. But I want to also say we had a comment here from Judah Isbaran. He said, cows is for baby cows. Cow's milk is for baby cows. And he also said, when people begin to value themselves and what they choose to nourish themselves with, the unethical manner in which they treat animals and nature will cease. And Becky Barnes says, of course I'm worried about the way animals are treated. I think it's wrong for humans to assume we are of higher intelligence when it's humans that are wrecking the earth. Becky, I love that. I couldn't agree more. What do you think, John? You think
it is humans that are wrecking the earth. There's no question. I don't think it's inevitable that we should do that, you know. We have the capacity to reflect, and we have the capacity to change, and that's where my hopes are, because if we continue as we've done, if we continue plagiarizing, dominating, predators, you know, we are exploiting everything, every resource, every ecosystem, every species we can make revenue out of, we exploit. And if we continue with that attitude that other beings are ours to exploit, that the natural world only has value insofar as we can convert it into revenue, and other people only have value insofar as they are service to us, if we continue to do that, I shudder at the harm we will bring about, and at the reckoning that will be inevitable.
Either there won't be much of a planet left. You know, the planet will be here, but as far as the biosphere, I wouldn't give it a lot of hope. Or there won't be any people, which perhaps would be a just ending to the whole story.
It may be, and it would be. I'm still fighting for it. You know, I'm a fighter. I want to see us outgrow our exploitation mentality, where we think we are because we dominate. I think it's in us to create partnerships with life, and I think we have to have. You know, one of the things I love about your work, Veronica, is that you talk about sex, and so many of us have shut down in so many ways. Our culture is shut down in so many ways around sex. But I think that's part of what drives the craziness and the exploitation and the militarism. I think if we made love more and less and made war less, we'd be happier and the whole planet would just breathe much, much easier.
Well, and it's become cliche, unfortunately, and a lot of people, you know, it elicits smirks and smiles that people don't take it seriously. But really, there's a lot of research that would support that, you know, whether you're studying cultures in La Paz, Mexico, or the Muswa in China, or the bonobos in the Congo. The sexually, you know, permissive or sex-positive cultures tend to be nonviolent. It's just a correlation.
Yeah, they don't beat their children. They're nicer to their elders. They're nicer to women. They don't necessarily assume that strangers are out to kill them. And they live and let live. We have that within us. It's part of our heritage. We just have to make some choices about what we're going to cultivate in ourselves, what we're going to nurture, and what we're going to strengthen in our children, how we're going to be on this earth. And I'm one of these people. People call me a dreamer, and I am. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think having dreams connects us to other realities that bring wisdom. I wish more of us remembered our dreams.
Our dreams are what create tomorrow.
Yeah.
May it
be a beautiful one. May we create a beautiful tomorrow. May we create a livable tomorrow. May we create tomorrows that speak of our hearts and connect us to our love. If we can do that.
Oh, I have to tell you something. We just got an instant message here. Nicholas Binion says, we love John Robbins.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I'm typing back. He says, thank you. I want to make sure our listeners, speaking of you, John, make sure that our listeners know where to contact you. I've already posted your website on Facebook, but let's put it out there again, guys. It's www.johnrobbins.info, I-N-F-O. And over there you're going to find radio shows and podcasts and lots of amazing articles. Are these actually connected to Huffington Post or...
Well, all the ones that I've written for Huffington Post are there on johnrobbins.info, as are many other articles I've written over the years.
Yes, tons of them here. The one about the Chinese babies growing breasts is here. That's one I'm going to read as soon as we get off the air. It's just shocking to me. What about books? You've had tons of them. They're all bestsellers. And, you know, I suppose the big one that a lot of people know about is Diet for a New America. But, you've got like, I don't know, 10 of them here, something like that. Any that you particularly want to highlight for our listeners tonight? Or maybe you
just
want to piece them with the new book.
My latest book is called The New Good Life, Living Better Than Ever in an Age of Less.
Okay.
The old good life, we know what that was. Shop till the planet drops. Shop till you're emotionally and economically exhausted.
Right.
You are what you buy. You know, that's insane. That's the consumerism. But it's dominated, particularly our younger kids. You know, they get inundated with it. We need to protect them from that. protect them from the predations of television and the corporate agenda. So they can live according to their innermost purposes. Their true purpose for being alive is not to shop. It's not to impress people with the clothes that they own or wear. It's much deeper than that. Being a human being is much more challenging than just buying stuff. But we got to. So the new good life is about freeing ourselves from that trance and finding value and beauty in our relationships with each other, in our relationships to the natural world, in our creativity, in our passions, in our capacities for joy and laughter, in our ability to bring beauty to the world, to make the world a little bit a better place, kinder place, happier place, brighter place, because we've been there.
Well, speaking of bringing beauty to the world, I do have to read these titles because they themselves are quite beautiful. We've got The New Good Life, Living Better Than Ever in an Age of Less, and The Diet for a New America, How Your Food Choices Affect Your Health, Happiness, and the Future of Life on Earth, The Food Revolution, How Your Diet Can Help Save Your Life and Our World, Healthy at 100, The Scientifically Proven Secrets of the World's Healthiest and Longest Lived People, May All Be Fed, Diet for a New World, The Awakened Heart, Meditations on Finding Harmony in a Changing World, and finally, Reclaiming Our Health, Exploding the Medical Myth and Embracing the Source of True Healing. That's quite a lineup. You've got another one in the works, right? Are you working on the next one?
I probably am about to give birth to a new baby book, but I don't really know what it's going to be yet.
Well, I have every confidence it's going to be perfect, whatever it is.
Thank you. Well, I look forward to your involvement in it.
Any angel dust I can blow in your direction, I will be only honored.
Thank you.
Only honored. I think that we're about time we wrapped it up here. Any final words you have?
Well, you know, our listeners, each of us has the ability to celebrate our lives. Whatever the conditions we find ourselves in, you know, whether we're rich or poor, whether we're healthy or not, we all want to prosper. We all want to be healthy, but life brings us different situations. And whatever the situation you're in, know that someone else is standing alongside you that you may not know about. I mean, you may not be able to see them because they may not be available to your senses. They may be in a different plane than that, but they're there. And they're with you, and they're caring for you, and they're loving you, and they're supporting you, and they're standing with you. And to know that we're not alone, even in our deepest suffering, in grief, is makes a big difference. To know that your love matters, and what you do makes a difference, and who you choose to be, and how you choose to be, is part of the tomorrow that we're creating together. So I just want to acknowledge the celebration that's going on, the art, the poetry, the dance, the singing, on behalf of what can yet be in our lives, in our world, and in our tomorrows.
Yeah. Amen to that. And all the people who are working so hard to make this a less cruel planet, too. And there are a lot of people who are working for that.
Yeah. Bravo for them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And every choice each of us makes to make our lives a little less cruel, a little less violent, a little less mean, and a little less bitter.
Well, I think that's the whole point, is that don't get so overwhelmed with the fact that there's 6.5 billion of us, and that there's some very, very powerful people who, you know, hold a little more sway about how things are going than they should. Every little difference that any of us makes, really, it does reverberate out there, you know?
It does. It does. We are a lot more connected than we often think.
Yeah.
We're part of each other's destinies. We're part of each other's dreams. We're part of each other's inner lives more than we know, because we're kind of taught to think of ourselves as separate more than we are.
And when we remember
our interconnectivity with all of life, then we stand and walk in a harmony, in a unison, in a connection with greater forces. And they can then bless our lives.
And that's the whole point about the factory farming, because the suffering that's taking place there isn't happening in some void separate from our lives. It is creating a suffering that's spreading throughout the whole planet. And, you know, just as we spread the suffering to them, their suffering spreads back to us, and it is connected.
It really is. So we could start circulating love. We can start circulating kindness. We can start circulating beauty. We can start circulating, you know, and just sending it out, filling our lives with it, treating others with it, making our choices in terms of it, treating animals that way, treating people that way, treating people who are like us that way, treating people who are unlike us different that way, treating people who are of the same gender and other genders. The more kindness, caring, and compassion we circulate, the more wisdom we circulate, the more thoughtfulness we circulate, the better our lives and our world can be.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know, what's so hard about that. To me, that's what makes life worth living.
I agree. And you just got to find that balance between letting go and getting involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
you, Veronica. Let go of your resentments and get involved. All right. John, all right. I could talk to you for another hour, but we're out of time.
I know we are. Well,
thank
it's been
you
fun
so
as
much.
Always.
Oh, always. Thanks for joining me in the Shame-Free Zone. It was a real pleasure. And back to the listeners here. I want to let you all know I am actually going to be sending out this month's newsletter. Yeah. I always send it the last day of the month. I guess that's because I'm trying to make sure that you've had a chance to read all of your other August newsletters. I'm not sure. Maybe it's just because this has been the absolutely busiest year of my life. But I promise it's going out sometime tomorrow. And I also want to let you know that I'm going on tour yet again. It's a real short, quickie trip out to the Bay Area. I'll be going up to Santa Rosa, Napa, and down into San Jose, and, of course, San Francisco. So if you live anywhere between San Jose and Napa and you want a personal house call, that's what I do when I'm on the road. I will come to your home. I will see you as an individual. I'll see you as a couple. I am bringing my anger management manual with me and my vulva puppet. So depending on whether or not you want to work with connection around sex or connection around emotions, let me know. You can reach me before I leave, and I leave Wednesday, September 1st, by calling the 800 number, 888-903-0050, or you can just decide to text me while I'm on the road. I'll have my cell phone with me, and I will also be checking email. That cell phone number is 415-407-2932. That's 415-407-2932. I hope to see you on the road, and I will be back here in the Shame-Free Zone on Monday at 9 Pacific. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian.